Welcome to International Clearance, the podcast that follows, chronicles, and speaks with British players and coaches leaving these isles to go ply their trade abroad and overseas. I am your co-host, Joe Walker. Alongside me, as always, Scully.
Good evening. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling very energized after an amazing, a horrible weekend of football, except for you, and a great week of Champions League football. I'm obviously speaking before Arsenal play Bayern Munich.
Yes. So we've just come in off the back of the Tuesday night Champions League game. So that is PSG knocking out Barcelona, but I guess more pertinently for us, Dortmund overturning that deficit against Atletico Madrid, winning 4-2 in the end. So we already have two English players in the Champions League semi-finals, with or without Arsenal. Sancho plays 85 minutes. Jamie Bynoe-Gittens again, I think, played a little bit more.
Yeah.
Whenever we've popped in over there, we've spoken about him as having played 10 minutes or so.
I think you got a good 30 there.
Yeah, he came on at about 65 minutes. It's a lot of faith for someone, because at that point, like, Atletico is still in front on aggregate there. So yeah, it's a statement for him to back him in that way. And then within 10 minutes, they've scored two goals. So not to give him full credit on any of those, because it's a really good team performance, but he's really part of that side that's into the Champions League semi-finals now, 19. The question now is, are they going to be joined by the British contingent at Arsenal, or will it be Harry Kane and Eric Dier?
I'm really hopeful. After watching Dortmund, I'm really hopeful that Arsenal can make it through, and I don't know why. I don't know why I think that.
Harry Kane, by the way, in his pre-match press conference, you know, with the Champions League, they do it the day before. He's basically fronted up and said, if we don't win the Champions League, this season is a complete failure as far as Bayern Munich go, which is not, you know, that shouldn't be a shock to anyone. That's the standard, the high standard that Bayern Munich operate at. And of course, that is the only front they're fighting on now, because Leverkusen actually confirmed their title on the weekend. 5-0 win over Werder Bremen in the end. It's their first Bundesliga title in their history. Five games to go. That's quite something. It's not a shock. It's been coming. We've kind of been talking about it for a number of weeks now, but it is cemented. And I guess all that's left to do is offer big congrats to Nathan Teller, Lambeth's very own.
Jeez, I'm very happy for Nathan Teller, man. Imagine that. Like, you've moved over. You've got relegated to Southampton. Yeah. You've moved to Bundesliga, trying a bit of a new challenge. And in the first season, you have won a Bundesliga title. That has to feel amazing. Probably feeling on top of the world. And we know that he wasn't necessarily, you know, the first choice player. But he did get a lot of game time. 20 games, 5 goals in the league. That is very good.
And he's played a lot of their European run as well, which may yet still bring another trophy. They're going to play West Ham late this week. He's been quite prominent in those games, in those fixtures. And so the kind of fairy tale season may not even be over for Nathan Teller, but yeah, got promoted with Burnley, and then rather than go, all right, let's ride that adventure, I think he's made the better call and hopped straight to Leverkusen and made history and been part of what looks like a party, I presume, that's still going on since the weekend.
Yeah. Remember when Liverpool finally won the Premier League and they turned up to every game from then hungover?
Yeah.
Those last like 2-3 games this season, they were just like getting smashed by any team. Yeah. They didn't care. Kind of need that to happen to Leverkusen right now.
Yeah.
I can't have a new invincible team come to the table.
Honorary mention, by the way, Jeremy Frimpong. I feel like we don't really talk about him when we go to Leverkusen.
Yeah.
He's Dutch, but, and has Dutch caps, but moved to England at about 9 and was in Man City's academy up till pro age. Then gets a move to Celtic, where he shines and gets his move to Leverkusen.
Quality at Celtic, by the way.
And if you've heard him speak, there's been a few clips going around. His voice has been stained by British living.
He's got the Mancunian twang, for sure.
Ticks a couple of the boxes, just not enough of them, I suppose.
Well, what do we do if he moves back to the Prem? There's rumours United want him, because obviously City Academy, now he's won the league title, all of this. I really hope they leave him alone. He looks so happy, just let it be. But if he was to come back to the UK and he was like, I want to do an interview, you guys, do we do it?
Yeah, of course. Why not?
I think he deserves it, you know. I think he deserves it.
Here's the thing about our rules that we've bound ourselves with. we can change them at any point. Like,
well, Jeremy, we're welcoming you. Incredible story. It's really weird. Leverkusen are one of those teams. It's almost like this is the fairy tale ending that rarely ever happens.
But yeah, that's one league win wrapped up. I wanted to quickly mention another league title decided in India. I don't think we've gone back to the Indian Super League since the very first episode of International Clearance.
And for that, we're very sorry.
Yes. Peter Ramage, our first ever guest in episode 1, about his time, amongst others, in the Indian Super League. That's still available, of course, on your feed. Funnily enough, episode 2, our guest was David Priest. He's now a goalkeeping coach in the Indian Super League at Bengaluru. But that's not a team we want to talk about today. We are going to Calcutta. Mohun Bagan SG is the name of the club. Not one I was familiar with, but they have been in the title race of the Indian Super League all season. On the final day of the regular season, Mumbai City are top. Them of the City group, like many others, like Melbourne City, yeah. Like New York City. Mohun Bagan play them on the last day of the season. They beat them 2-1 to go over them and win the regular season. I tell you this, ladies and gentlemen, because the winner for Mohun Bagan was scored by a Scotland cap, but also more recently, Australia international, Jason Cumings. Ex-Hibs, Rangers, Forest, Shrewsbury, Dundee. He moved to Australia, played for Central Coast Mariners before moving to India for this season. But as part of, I think he's got family there, but we've spoken about it before, there's actually quite a lot of Scottish contingent in the Australian squad that for the Asia Cup this year. Jason Cummings is one of those. He played in the Qatar World Cup for them. He's got a few caps for Australia. His nickname is the Cum Dog, self-styled, which I thought you might enjoy, Scully.
Crazy nickname. I have no idea why you'd ever give yourself that nickname. But I guess when that's your surname, you have to lean into it.
Yeah, I think you should also look up him generally in your own time. And I think you two, listen, if you don't know about Jason Cummings, just kind of put his name in on YouTube or on Twitter or something like that, or even like Instagram, TikTok. Known as being a bit of a character during his time in Scotland, a bit of an unserious guy, but at this level, he's going to bag your goals. He's basically got 1 in 2 for this Indian side, Mohun Bagan. It just means they're into the playoffs now, but they've won the regular season. But the championship trophy is decided by a playoff with the top 6. So what is important so far, they get seeded into the semi-finals of the playoffs, which is like actually from the quarterfinal stage. And then here they qualify for the Asian Champions League as well, which I guess is a bit more interesting. But yeah, there's a few videos going around on like to Scots Abroad, the pod I shouted out in the first episode of this new season. They posted some videos of the celebrations of him scoring the winner in that game. He's pretty much on his own. There's a couple of Australians in the team, Cummings, and then mostly Indian players. It's not as flush with foreign nationals as it once was and big names. Certainly not as the time, you know, when we spoke to Ramage and it was this kind of so many big names out there, Roberto Carlos and Matarazzi and players like that. No, it's a little scaled down a little bit more now, but yeah, there's Brits out there making a difference still. We'll go a bit more local. Let's get to France. And a player we've not spoken about, I don't think, on the show yet. Ainsley Maitland-Niles. He's at Lyon.
My boy.
And I thought of you when this happened, because I remember you doing a game of fives with Copper 90, debating who would you want in your all-time, kind of like Mount Rushmore of penalty takers in a shootout.
Yeah.
And you threw this shout of Ainsley Maitland-Niles based on, I guess, one penalty he took for Arsenal or something.
It wasn't one, he took a lot. Yeah, he took a lot, never missed one.
Okay. He's at Lyon, who have had a sort of famously bad start to the season, but kind of take another look at Ligue 1, and they are in 7th place, 3 points off European spots.
Yeah, they can do it. They're making a late push.
Yeah. And part of that comeback, the latest installment of that, they hosted Brest, who are second in Ligue 1, by the way. Brest were 3-1 up against Lyon. And then Lyon pull it back to 3-3, and they get a penalty late. I'm talking the 106th minute it has to be taken. I think both sides have had red cards. It's obviously one of those games where VAR's gone mad, everyone's fuming, cards flying around. And, you know, who is the one player on the pitch that should step up in that moment who has the calm record? you'd be there to tell me it's Ainsley Maitland-Niles. And
it had to be.
So it proves his first league goal. He waited for his opportunity. I guess he was just waiting for the... He doesn't take all the penalties. He's just waiting for the right one to be given to him. You know, so don't worry. Give this one to me. I'm the pressure penalty.
Yeah, 106 minutes gone. Yeah, everybody's lost their head. Like you said, red cards all over the gaff. Manager's probably in the stands by now. Fans are probably like, they're really boiling over. I watched the penalty. Ainsley didn't care. Just takes a breather, does his run up, slots it. Normal. I'm really happy for him because his start at Lyon, obviously at the beginning of the season, they were in the relegation battle. Awful, awful, awful time. And you know what it's like when your team is underperforming. Any player is fair game for the fans. Doesn't matter who you are, how long you've been attached to the club, you are fair game. And obviously, as a new player coming from the Premier League, playing fullback or wing back for them, they were really onto Ainsley. Oh, is he even defending? He's not even getting game time. He's alternating a lot. He's not really getting enough chance to prove what he can do. In the last few months, 3-4 months especially, he's kind of cemented himself as a bit of a favourite. They start to really like him. I'm seeing him pop up in all their promos. It's really funny because obviously they'll have someone asking questions in French and then it'll pal up to Ainsley and he'll answer deadpan English like, oh, what am I listening to? Oh, what's my screensaver? And he's really starting to cement himself as a fan favourite there. And I think this is the perfect second chance he needed. Like, he's just got a little bit of a way to get away from the English media, focus on his football. If they make it back to the European spots, it's a touch. He's had a great time. He's had an absolutely great time doing a little Europa League conference campaign with Lyon. Can't complain, man. You absolutely cannot.
He did in that Roma loan get a Conference League winners medal because
he played three
of the games. He didn't play in the final. He's on the bench, but did play in the running. So interesting.
I forgot he already has a European trophy technically.
Yeah. And sort of, well, the 10 years mention of Italy, let's make a little jump to some sadder news. So we kind of...
I blame this on you, by the way.
How dare you? How dare you? We spoke about ITVX now doing free-to-air Serie A games here in the UK between now and the end of the season every Saturday evening. The one that we pushed was Bologna v Monza. And the player we wanted everyone to watch was Lewis Ferguson. If you took our advice, you sat down in time to see Lewis Ferguson rupture his ACL, end his season, not just for Bologna, but Scotland.
I'm so sorry.
He's going to miss Euro 2024. Almost certainly misses out on a move this summer because he's probably... It's the kind of injury that you're out for, even if you've had a really lucky run, 7-8 months.
Mm-hmm.
Think of what 7-8 months' time is. That's November, December. If they do make the Champions League, Bologna, which might be tough now without him for the remainder of the sort of half a dozen games, he might miss their group stage entirely. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's likely that Motta is snapped out because he's done an amazing job. Motta is, of course, not only the manager right now of Bologna, but he's the guy who super highly rates Ferguson. And it's not guaranteed he might not move, but if he is to move, then... Yeah, it's a really difficult one because it's a bit like he might be like, yeah, I really like you, Lewis. However, you're not going to be ready right now this year. I'll see how I feel next year. You move on. And you know how it gets in football. You know, it's exactly the same as people in working careers. Like somebody moves on and it's just your chance. You've missed your boat. I'm really hoping that isn't the case for Lewis Ferguson. I think Bologna finishing in the Champions League spaces and him being a very key player to that will probably be just about enough for him to at least be desirable.
Yeah, you just hope with an injury like that, he comes back the same. His body doesn't restrict him from kicking on or even being the same player he was before. Mm-hmm. That's an absolute sickener. Another sickener, injury-wise, more so on the timing rather than severity of the injury, is Jesse Lingard. You know, we put out a TikTok of a clip of when we spoke about him a couple of weeks ago, and about how it's been going. There's been a BBC piece which kind of confirms a few of what your things were suggesting, Scully, in terms of like cultural differences and actually some of the comments, certainly a Korean journalist was suggesting that the managerial comments are kind of misinterpreted by Western readers and journalists because is way more motivating than actually the tone we take it in.
Yeah, and you can't interpret the tone and all of these certain things, which just goes to say that International Clearance and myself and Joe are as good as BBC journalists, and you should come to us for all your football-based news. We could have told you that. We could have told you that without any Korean translator. So
I just hope people listen to the episode and find that out. Because I know the clip didn't quite include all of that. Hey, you threw him. So we might have been missed. But hey, no one's had a go at us for it. That's the start.
Well, if you want to go and leave us some abuse on the TikTok, you can go and find us on TikTok at INTL Clearance. Mm-hmm. Please don't actually abuse us. Just share with your friends. You know,
comments helpful. We'll go back and forth for you.
All that good stuff. Reading that BBC piece, it did say that the manager was actually happy with his attitude. He was posting games. He was going to training and taking that seriously and all of this. So hopefully we were right and it was just a fitness issue and he'll be on the way back up.
Yeah, but that won't be immediately because that piece does mention he underwent knee surgery on Friday. So the extent of how long he'll be out for, we're not sure, but his kind of progress, it's on pause for now. Like in terms of kicking on, it will have to wait a little bit longer. I know it's only the start of their season, remember? So there is still months and months of that campaign to go for him to sort himself out and make a difference there. But yeah, fully on pause now, the kind of Lingard K-League story until he recovers from that surgery. Should we get into our guest?
So I think we should. We absolutely should. I know they've been waiting a while.
Has been overdue. Haven't had to post some passport stamps for quite some time. But we've got our act together and we've ticked off a country that we haven't done. I think the last episode of the first season, we got our first Scot and we said we need to get some Welsh people on and someone from Northern Ireland. Well, this week we've got someone who has caps for the Northern Ireland under 23 side. Born in Craigavon, his name is Tam Stewart, or Thomas Stewart, as we referred to him as, because I thought that was a bit unfamiliar to call him by Tam, I thought. I don't know. Wolves Academy, but pro career mostly in Ireland, Northern Ireland, had a spell at Partick Thistle in Scotland. He also played in the US and Canada, which we discuss. He's currently in the Swedish fourth tier, Division 2 Norrland, managing Utterhogda IK, a club I think we've discussed off air, but not actually, it's something that's made an edit before. A real long reputation of a lot of British and Irish players going over there for a season. I'm talking teenagers, freshly released from academies or trying to match the discipline and professionalism of academy training and football without distractions, going isolated, keeping themselves in the football system for a year and then going back to, well, anywhere really, but ideally back to the English pyramid to, you know, re-energise their professional careers. Utterhogda's got a really long record of doing that. It's interesting.
There's a friend of the show, actually, who played for Utterhogda, so I believe.
Yeah, Moses, who we've worked with at Copper 90, Game of Fives, the show we mentioned earlier. Former footballer, was like Barnet Academy, but then played abroad for a couple of things. We'll probably get him on at some point. That makes sense.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we probably got him. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but yeah, played at Utterhogda. But yeah, it's a club where Thomas Stewart is making his managerial bow. Just started his second season there. And I just thought, because the story of the club, you know, found out about him because of the club, did some reading on it, and just by chance, thought, who's in charge there now? Who's there that we can speak to? Well, we got the manager, Thomas Stewart, right here on International Clearance. Thank you, firstly, Thomas, for speaking with us. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm very well. Obviously, doing a lot better now that the season's underway. We've got a few points on the board, so makes life a little bit easier on that end. But yes, how about you?
Brilliant. All the better for having you on. Before we get talking Utterhogda, I wanted to touch on a couple of spells of your playing career first, that's okay. You had this great senior playing career in the Irish Premiership, the League of Ireland, the spell at Partick Thistle as well. But then at 2014, you make the jump to Sacramento Republic, a kind of new club in sort of the USL Pro League, which is in its sort of third, fourth year of existence. What was the club's pitch to you at that point?
Major League Soccer was the kind of goal within 3 years. They believed I was good enough to help them get on the map. And basically, that was the selling point. Obviously, California probably helped there a little bit as well.
Yeah.
But certainly, for me, I love taking new challenges, and I thought, you know, I've done everything in Ireland, and kind of like I got the experience of it to see my professional career starting off at Wolves in England. So I felt that that was good. I was contracted to the Premier League, albeit not playing in the Premier League, but certainly then going up to Scotland and playing in the SPFL, which was great. But I felt like it had those kind of British, you know, Irish kind of adventures, and I just felt I wanted something more. And again, if it didn't work out, I could always come back. And it was a fantastic time. Now, we didn't get a Major League, and the club still haven't got Major League, which is disappointing. But to go out there and to achieve some of the stuff I did was, you know, fantastic.
Given it's a new franchise at the time, even with those ambitions, coming in on the ground, if you like, what kind of attendances are we talking? How quickly did the local area kind of take to the setup?
It just went booming straight away. There was no expectation on that, really. It was more... Sacramento's probably, obviously, it's the capital of California, and there's probably in the region of about 3 million people, give or take. But it's such a like spread out city. It's not like your typical kind of like, let's take, for example, Belfast, when there's maybe 500,000 or 600,000 people in the city. But this is like a spread out city, so you wouldn't know there's anywhere near 3 million people there. All of a sudden, we're hearing that there's maybe going to be 2,000-3,000 people. And you're thinking, all right, that's okay for a startup club. All of a sudden, we were getting sellouts. The first game of the season, we had 20,000 fans, and then it just kept going and going and going. And that was just credit to probably the marketing has a lot of, you know, good there, but just a place that was craving football, soccer out there, as they call it. But men and women, boys and girls were limited to that. The capital city, the capital of California, not having a football club to represent is really unheard of. So I think that's obviously what set the fire out there, but it was brilliant.
What was the lifestyle like there then? You mentioned already that there was an appeal there for you. Did you move your family out there with you? Was that?
No, I went on my own. At the time, obviously, I had a girlfriend, but it just was one of those things that it was such a great opportunity and something I felt very compelled to do. And it was just, again, something that I thought I could make an impact, and I wanted to make an impact further afield and really try and put every single bit of effort into professional football in a different country and different kind of culture. But just touching on that, it was just fully focused on football. And I could have been back home in Ireland for most of it, for all I know, because I was just solely there to focus on football. So I didn't really take in the kind of lifestyle until maybe the second or third year a little bit more. I was just fully zoned into what I was needing to do.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And to be fair, you can see that on the pitch with your results, Thomas. I mean, leading scorer first season. There's a hat trick, the first hat trick in a club's history. I've seen that written somewhere. Can't never take that off you. And you come second in the league, but you win those playoffs. So you're champions in your first year. That must have felt at that time like, well, we're really cooking something here. This is really coming together.
You probably don't expect to go out and win something in your first year because it's so new. But I've always challenged. I've always competed. So I would like to think I'm up at the top end and every team I've been with. Or maybe one have been, you know, challenging. So I did expect that off myself and my team to challenge it in every way, but maybe not come out on top. But certainly finishing second in the league is kind of a strange thing, because you wouldn't normally celebrate that over in America. It's about getting into the playoffs, and the bigger thing is winning the championship rather than the actual league. So that was a little bit strange, but certainly you can feel it out there. Nobody really... Not cares, but it doesn't have the same pull, because even if you finished eighth, you're in the playoffs, the same as basketball. You've achieved something special getting to the playoffs, and then it's anybody's game. So that's where the competition heats up. But certainly finishing high up in the league gives you that bit of momentum and kind of belief that you've beaten other teams kind of, you know, below you, so to speak. And certainly when we went into the playoffs, we really fancied ourselves to go as far as we could, and coming out on top was a brilliant feeling.
What other kind of obvious differences from what you're used to did you experience, particularly in that time at Sacramento? I'm seeing that the USL Pro League at the time, you've got a lot of affiliate teams I've seen, or second teams of MLS sides. Well, did that have a kind of general effect on the standard or the kind of atmosphere in games? What was it like sort of playing against those kind of teams in your division?
I always felt that was better, because you always had the best youth academies or some of the first team playing, or when I say some of the first team, it wasn't like all teams were good, but it had some teams like Seattle Sounders 2 or LA Galaxy 2. So there was a lot of drip-fed players from the first team coming in, or some starlets coming through. So that was they were always good matches, but always playing good football. They're always trying to play from the back. And and possess. So the tactics were always different. The tactics were always challenging. But the hardest part for me, and I think every player was, and not many people know it, but obviously coming from Ireland, you're playing in sometimes just, you know, 5 or 6 degrees or up to 10. Someday on a good day, it gets hot, but it was constantly like 35 degrees every single day in Sacramento. It's a valley. It's just so much heat. So you're adapting to that. During the day, you don't really, like, people are like, oh, California must have been nice going to the beach. Number one, there were no beaches where I was, but at the same time, the downtime, you're having to really be really disciplined and stay indoors, put the air conditioning on, rehydrate, stretch off, get your body back up to 100% because it was so challenging. So the difficulties for me were the conditions every week because we would have trained and we would have been ready for what we need to do in Sacramento. All of a sudden, then you're flying, and sometimes on red-eye flights to Colorado, which is at altitude, Real Salt Lake, which is at altitude, you're down at LA, and it might be hot, and then you're playing on the rubber 4G. So the surface is different. So there's a lot of different challenges. And then all of a sudden, you come back to Sacramento, and you're playing 3 days later. Then, and especially the first year, not so much now, which is obviously the divided leagues in half, east against west. We were flying to the East Coast in the first year, back to the West Coast, back to the East Coast. So it was a lot tougher than maybe people can see from the outside, but certainly that's why it holds much more weight that we won something in the first year, because it wasn't divided in two leagues. It was just we were going right, left. So it, I think it made it more special.
Yeah. The second season, you've Paul Buckle comes in. And how different was that season compared to the first?
For me, you know, before Paul came in, it was, I think, too many outsiders came into the club. And I mean, when I say that, like trialist players, the club somehow was just going through a load and load of different players. I think we had at one point maybe like 12 extra trialist players were training with us, and that's not healthy for the team. And it was ongoing through pre-season and certainly into the season, which took away from, in my opinion, the squad harmony that we had, the kind of the work we'd put in. You know, and you feel it as players, you know, you want to be tight, you want to be a tight-knit family. And I felt there was little distractions. That's generally how I felt. For me, even a little bit further, I had a horrible, I had to go through surgery on my foot. It was painful. It put me out for months. So I lost my form. I lost my accessory navicular bone, which I think there's only like 3% of the people in the world have it. So yeah, it was such a strange kind of feeling having to get that surgery. And then relearn how to kick the ball, I suppose, with that, it's on the instep of your foot. So it's a difficult kind of feeling when you're striking the ball. And obviously then there's the tenderness and then you can't play properly until that goes. But I'm trying to rush back. So probably didn't do myself any favours that way. And then certainly when I came back in, I did well, still under a previous manager. I just think he fell a wee bit out of love with me. He was one of those ones. He thought I was maybe one of the older ones at 27. And I think he just wanted his own kind of players after that. And for no particular reason, because it scored a hat-trick in the cup, and these things happen in football, so it's just one of those things. And then Paul came in, I started well under Paul, and then it was a case of, I'd seen some of the senior players were just starting to like be fed out of the club, and you could sort of feel the heat on your back then coming towards you. So again, I've seen it in football clubs, I know how they work, it's a business at the end of the day, but certainly I feel like the group that we had at the start, if we'd have maybe managed that a little bit better, I think we could have gone on to win another trophy if we'd have added one or two players to that. I do.
Can you say the name of that bone again? Only 3% of the people in the world have it.
Yeah, accessory navicular bone. So if anyone wants to look it up. So it's basically my foot's like, and I have a bone that sort of like sticks out, points out a little bit. Mine broke. So it's not really one of those things that cause you too much trouble unless you're athletic and you're pounding the ground and you get tackles. So the amount of tackles I've had on my feet, yeah, at some point it was bound to break. So yeah, it was a difficult one because it was just so much pain. And then after that, again, people probably don't see it, and I'm not looking at any sympathy for anybody, but I'm on my own and I'm trying to hobble about on crutches. You get upstairs, you're trying to shower, you're trying to bathe, you're trying to drive. It's difficult, you know. It's the hardest part about being a footballer is being injured. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it.
Moving to Canada, what was the situation there that led to that move generally?
I felt like it was just sort of being edged out. You know, I'd seen a couple of other players with the same sort of experience, and it just felt like that's what was happening. I felt that the injury was detrimental, really, to me. And, you know, that's a part of the job. That's the ugly side of football. But I had no hesitations with Canada because it was Paul Dalglish phoned me. So there's not many, obviously everybody knows his dad, and then certainly he's had a good, he's a good pedigree, he's a good coach. He's done well in America, both on and off the field as a player and a coach. So he phoned me up and it was an easy decision. So I had options to go different places in California and different clubs, but I had no hesitation. What I wanted to do was work with the best manager that would give me still the best opportunity. And I've tried to take opportunities along the way that'll encourage me and help me for the now as a coach, because I always felt that was something I would go down the route of. And I was always trying to learn off the best. And Paul being a striker as well, I felt that that was a good fit.
What were your kind of main takeaways from his management style?
Loved to play football, wanted to play football, wanted to play attacking football, but very methodical in terms of, like, they would have been very, he loved the information. He was very much in it. And a lot of things I agree with in terms of, like, decision-making being the number one tool in football that players need. A lot of people think, oh, the technique or the vision or the way to pass. The decision-making has to be the absolute crucial thing. And he was all about that. And he tried to do those things in training. And that's something as a coach that every day I'm trying to challenge players with their decision-making, you know, the speed of thought, how they perform on a daily basis and challenging their thought process, really.
What was your general assessment of that season with Ottawa Fury then?
It was a strange one. I always knew it was going to be difficult because we were lower down the league, and there was nothing really, don't get me wrong, nothing to fight for, but certainly I felt that getting into the top two or three was going to be so difficult. And then you'd obviously see teams like the Miami teams who were spending an absolute fortress on players. Nesta was the manager of one. And then, you know, you were getting all the best. I think Amari, who played against whenever he was at Juventus, was down at Fort Lauderdale. So, you know, it was top quality players. And then it's one of those ones that I went there to try and learn off the person. And I think that's what's benefited me over the years. I've made right decisions. And obviously I knew we weren't going there to win the league with Ottawa, but I felt like I could still learn an awful lot in a short space of time under Paul. And I think I did.
How did it feel to go from California to Canada? How was that?
Different, but Canada was brilliant. Beautiful place. Great people. Really, really good people. And the weather during the summer surprised me because it was really, really hot. So it was a lot of similarities for that reason. But again, I went there just fully focused on the football. We were playing in a brilliant stadium, full-time training, good people around me, good teammates. So I felt like I learned a lot there as well. But I needed that change after things were starting to sort of change at Sacramento for me.
And that's kind of where we'll leave your playing days. Obviously, there's more football there. You play for Larne as well. But the route to your current job now, I know there was coaching in with the IFA, with women's football, with university football. How do you find Utahugdo?
You're on the ladder and you just want more. I'm so passionate about what I do. I love what I do. It's been my life and will be my life. And I'm in a privileged position to help other people and give back and share some of the experiences I've had and some of the good things that have happened, share those, some of the bad things I can help other people with as well. And kind of lean into that kind of care as well as, you know, being a mentor as well as a coach. But certainly at the time I felt like, you know, I'd done everything in Northern Ireland, kind of like building up my CV that I was ready to go. I was looking and looking and looking, and I had a couple of people had reached out to me about going to America potentially, but just as a coach, it wasn't really like what I wanted. I wanted to be a manager. I wanted to sample as assistant manager, maybe at a higher club. And then I was just looking up job boards and different places that I could interview for. And yeah, luckily enough, I got speaking to a couple of people. And whenever the sports chief reached out to me as well through a list of names that were given to him through Jobs for Football, it was my name that was the number one candidate. So I built up a decent, you know, CV in a short space of time. And obviously from international football as well, to the biggest university in Belfast, what it was doing, you know, was developing a lot of players and being successful at it. And obviously then even in the women's team as well, we'd got the team into the Champions League for the first time, won the league for the first time in I don't know how many years, but certainly I was throwing everything at it. Then I had a chance to go again to Australia, but I refused that offer because no disrespect to anywhere out there, but I feel like European football is obviously going to benefit me. Those jobs in Australia and places are going to come up at any given time, in my opinion. So I wanted to develop in Sweden, a place that I have a lot of respect for. I played international football against Sweden years ago, been there in the Champions League with Linfield, and they're a nation that's kind of really, you can see exactly now when I'm here, that's really starting to like ramp up, and there's a lot of exciting times happening for Swedish football. It's on the way up, and I felt that that was the right place and the right fit for me. And then obviously the Division 2 is obviously where Graham Potter started, and I saw a pathway from what he's done. And that's kind of where it came down to. And I want to emulate that. There's absolutely no reason why I can't, but certainly I'll work as hard as I can to be the best I can and trying to move up the leagues.
Obviously, you spoke about your playing days and your transition into management, but at what point do you know this is definitely something you want to do after playing?
When I was like 26, 27, I was still doing coaching. I was helping out little bits and pieces, but I think it's whenever you really embrace the impact you have on someone. I think that's kind of where you feel it, you know, and again, probably saw most of it out in America because you see a lot of kids coming and they're like, oh my goodness, that was amazing. Thank you so much for your time. You've helped my son or daughter, or, you know, or you get a letter or your text message. My kid made university, all those lessons you give him, you know, he made the university school. I had no idea. It was amazing. And then, for example, when I was out in Hawaii, I was taking some of the schools and then they sent me these massive file of paper thank yous, you know, what we're so blessed to have done this. We haven't had a coach come out or do these things. So I think whenever it impacts you, and again, you're doing something to give back and that gets you something in reward. I think that's the kind of joy that comes with it. So whenever you're giving something back, I think that's the most precious thing. And I think that's in an everyday life. But certainly because football, I'm passionate about it anyway, I love what I do. You're seeing people smile. And then I see now, especially now out of the hurdle, whenever I put on a session and you see boys enthusiastic, running, putting the extra heart in, feel like they'll run through a brick wall for you, and also the quality's there as well. But then they're actually making the right decisions. They're doing the right things in the game. They're trying to play it from the back. You're seeing you're kind of like, for better want the word, painting. You know, it's all about trying to paint pictures for players, and they're then on the pitch and they're painting it back at you, and it's just like, that's class to see. I love seeing that. So obviously the game's going to change. At some point I'll have to change my tactics, my ideas to adapt to whatever systems and styles come. But I think that's the beauty of it. Whenever you see something that you believe in so much, I remember doing, you said, how do you know? I remember doing a ball mastery for 50 or 60 kids on Zoom during COVID, and you're seeing them all doing the same thing and smiling and wanting more. It makes you want to do it more as well. When you get a result as well, there's no better feeling than getting a result. Then you might work hard and put all the information and not get a result, but because that's football. But certainly whenever you do, it makes it all the worthwhile and a little bit more sweeter. But just going back, sorry, I don't think there's like a defining moment. I think it's just like you kind of just fall in love with your passion. And I can't just do something unless I'm passionate about it. It's very difficult for me to go and do. I've tried different work and it's just not for me.
The more I've read about the Tohukdo and a lot of their recent history, there's this big pattern of British and Irish youngsters looking for more professional experience, discipline, a kind of year away to just do all the right things, tick all the right boxes to develop them as professionals, and then the club benefits from that. How much were you aware of that at the job opening, or indeed the more you spoke to the club about the project?
I suppose whenever I spoke about it, I was really exposed to kind of how bad it had been for a while, if I'm being brutally honest. Obviously, a lot of the players pre-COVID and pre-Brexit, you could get a lot of European players. Now it's just EU passport holders, you know, so it limits a lot of things. My kind of take on it was, I can go into a place and make it better. I believe I can do that. That was just my take. I can make it better no matter what I'm working with. They might not be my so-called players to begin with, but by the time they're finished with them, you know, I'll have left my mark and hopefully help someone to develop. And I think that's the big difference for this year. There's no disrespectful way I'm trying to say this, but I've now been able to recruit my players for the first year, and the club are really seeing the benefit of that because they've seen me as a person and as a development coach as well. And I'm not just a development coach, but I can develop players quickly, in my opinion, playing a good style of football. And I think that overall has come into place, and hopefully we can have a successful season on it, and we can do better than what we've done in the previous probably 5 or 6 years. And that is my hope, that is my goal. But certainly, whenever you take a job on, there's always someone else that has been there before you, has maybe done something differently, and some of it might be good. So you don't want to take away from the good, but some of the things that mightn't have been how you see it, a lot of it I flipped on its head, if I'm being perfectly honest. The way I see football is the modern day take. I've worked with some really, really top managers, so I have a feeling of how I want to progress it. And all these players I know are just going to be here for a season. So going into that, then especially, I'm really just going short-term goals. So I'm not going, okay, this is a five-year project. I'm going in, this is a short-term goal. This is, how do I get these players buying into what I want? The board, the staff, buying into what I need. And on the smaller club or budget or whatever you want to call it we're on, it's about trying just to be progressing, communicating, and trying to deliver as best as you can on a daily basis. I don't really look too far ahead, and it's not a club that I can look too far ahead with.
Quite an all-encompassing role as well, given that there was that one coach when you arrived who I think had sort of retired, unretired. You're really having to take everything on with that in mind. How much of a baptism of fire was that?
Yeah, well, if everybody knows, I'm the only coach here. You know, I have a helper that is my assistant, but he's not a football coach, and it's just the truth, and there's no harm saying that. But it's exposed me to so much, and I don't think some of the things I would have learnt at other clubs if everything had been all rosy and perfect. And that's been probably the biggest help to me, is just getting thrown into the deep end. And I think I've taken it on, and hopefully I'll get those opportunities higher clubs. I believe I will, and I believe I'll work hard enough to do it. But once I am able to get more people around me, I think it's going to be great.
As a place, how remote is Uttahogdo? Like, it's actually distraction-free. Are you, I guess you're allowed to quite, does that apply to the players as much as you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the good things, to be honest. It's kind of just, you come here and focus on football. I think it's a perfect club for someone that really wants full-time football, exposed to full-time football, gets the use of the good facilities, and then also is in a tough league. It is a tough league, but it's obviously tough weather. It's tough with the culture maybe to some of the boys, and then it's tough obviously with maybe some of the lads being away from home for the first time. But they adapt, and because they're all so close as a team, and they all only live like a minute away from each other, it's there's good camaraderie. So yeah, like I said, I think it's a good fit for any young footballer that wants to learn, or somebody that's maybe had an injury and needing to come back and build themselves up again.
That first season, you've mentioned a lot of the factors that probably contributed to it, but you get into the 12th place, but you survive on with the relegation playoff. How soon then, given I know that you said you have to think short term when it's not your players and you can't think way too beyond that. The season's done, you survived. Your pre-season plans, in terms of player turnover at this level, what are we talking? Is it quite substantial?
Everybody left. Right. So every year the whole team changes, and it's just an influx of new players. So it's such a difficult place. I don't think anybody really, really sees in depth how difficult it is. And I only was given my player budget in February to sign players. So we were the last team to arrive, and all the players then arrived 1st of March. So we've only 1 month to get the players singing and dancing and in tune together. So I'm delighted with how we've started. It's obviously going to be serious hard work from here on in, but I think that's, you know, testament to the players listening to what I'm trying to say, and obviously me as a coach trying to put good ideas in front of them. But it's all about the players. They're the ones that perform and obviously go and conduct themselves on a football pitch, which they're doing. And yeah, credit to them, but it's such a difficult start. And we only had 3 pre-season games, and that was in the space of 12 days.
Wow.
As a manager, was that your first relegation battle?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I knew that was going to be the case coming in. And I had no doubt in my mind that it would keep the team in the division. And that was our goal. Didn't shout it out loud or, you know, saying different to anybody else. But I knew it was going to be seriously tough because I had to get rid of 20-plus players. It was that bad. And I had to try and bring new players in and fresh blood. And whenever I was able to bring in my own players in the summer, they ended up being the top scorers for me. So I was delighted with that. But we, before the summer break, only had 2 wins, I believe. And now, the start of the season, we've got 2 out of 2. So it's quite a contrast. So hopefully that keeps going. I'm not getting complacent whatsoever. But that just shows you how difficult it was. And thankfully, after the summer, we went on a good run. We missed out staying up automatically by 1 point. There were, I think there were 3 teams in and around us, and they beat us by 1 point. So we had to go to the playoffs. But the boys did fantastically well in the playoffs overall. But I was so confident going into those games. But certainly, you just never know.
Mentally, when that confidence does drop, how do you not convey it to the players? How do you keep them thinking, we're going to do this, even if you might not be thinking it?
That's the challenge. That's the biggest challenge. When you're losing, morale goes, confidence goes, other players start to come and, why am I not playing? Or, you know, I could have done this. You know, you start to maybe go, well, we need to fix this quickly. We maybe need to just park the bus. You know, those are things that you think about as a coach. But I've always believed in myself. I've always, even though we weren't the strongest team, I still felt like I could get a blueprint for our team. And we challenged some of the top teams, even though we lost, we challenged them. So we had a lot of losses, but we actually challenged a lot of teams and we competed. But certainly whenever we came to the teams around us, it was so important in the second half of the season that we picked up points against them, and we did. And that was really the message, was compete against the big teams and show me you care. Show me that you're going to give it everything against the smaller teams, because that's where you win and lose. That's where you get points. You know, if you get points around the team against you, there's a good chance you're going to stay up if that's what your aim is. But certainly, I've always found that mindset as a winner. You beat the so-called banana skin teams, the ones that you slip up on. The big games look after themselves, because your mentality is just, you're just razor sharp. It's the complacency that creeps in against the bottom teams. So that was, I wanted us to still believe that we were the best team going into the kind of games of the caliber that were similar to us.
The amount of players you've referred to, even some as your players, and I guess despite being quite new into your managerial career, if you like, you obviously have a preference for what kind of players you would like to come in and stuff. What is your network? Are you leaning on existing relationships from your playing days? How's that all work out?
Yeah, well, again, I had no say in it whatsoever. And in the first year, all the players came. So I didn't get a say. They would have been through agents and through companies that had previously worked, I think, something like that. So I just wanted to get rid of that, just completely, you know, a clean slate and pick my own players. I have a distinct style of football, of a way I like to play, like to build up from the back. I like to have a high press from the front. So I need technical players, number one. So that's something I was looking for. Good attitudes, players that are going to give you 90 minutes, players that can last 90 minutes plus. And I think that's kind of like where we're at, because we're a full-time team. And anybody that maybe just look below that, I can help, I can develop them, I can push them and get them to a good place. So whenever I was recruiting players, it would have been reaching out to some of my kind of like older teams or people that I knew, people that I built relationship with, and I have a good network of people, good connections. So I was delighted with some of the players I've recruited with the budget that I have. And then obviously on the other side of it, the respect that the players have shown me, you know, so that's a key thing as well, to have that both ways. And it makes you trust each other a lot more, and certainly want to build on that as a team and have that kind of good bond. But certainly there's no special kind of secret to it. It's just like kind of connections that I've had in agencies, and a lot of people actually reach out to you, and there's some nice people that reach out to you, and there's been some worthwhile contacts through that all too. But generally speaking, leagues and teams like ours, a lot of people get in touch with you, and a lot of you get like lists of players that have been released from certain teams as well, and everybody kind of fights for the kind of I suppose the old Brad Pitt Moneyball kind of effect, you know. So that's kind of how it is at certain times as well.
Speaking from ignorance here, Thomas, I would imagine, given how sort of small Uitenhage is, it's got to be picturesque, right? Am I right in thinking it's a lovely place to live? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Sweden's beautiful in itself, but like we're surrounded by lakes and, well, snow. There's still a lot of snow here as well, but it's starting to slowly go. But yeah, it's woods, forest, lakes, moose, reindeer walking down the road at times. So yeah, it's a beautiful place. People are lovely. such a small village that we're in. There's only a couple of shops, and I think there's 500 people actually live in the community. So it's very, very small, but we're not far away from a couple of other bigger cities. But certainly, I think people underestimate how small it is when they come here. Definitely.
Wow. And what would your kind of overall 60-second kind of pitch be for coming to a club like Otago?
I think full-time football, number one, the experience of playing European football, the experience of having a brand of football, the experience of trying to move up to Superettan or Allsvenskan, two top leagues in Sweden. And again, it's a country that's on the way up, and the culture is good and the people are good. And like you touched on, the nature's good, and it's just it's a lovely part of the world. It really, really is. So I'll enjoy it for as long as I can here, and certainly the players that have been here, I haven't heard a bad word from them from the culture or the lifestyle as well.
Amazing.
One thing I've kind of realized is you have an affinity for like sports psychology and like looking at things quite differently to, I think you're quite a modern coach and manager. Is that something you'd learn kind of as you left playing, or is it something you've always been interested in?
Generally think it was good parenting. I do. I grew up in a good family, and I think that's kind of been my kind of personality, you know, and my character's kind of led by example. Attitude, you know, wouldn't have to be the loudest in the room, but I was respected. I cared for people, and I think that's kind of like how I am. But I think just over the years, I think you see different scenarios, and you see the way different managers speak to different people, and some of it's terribly wrong. I've been in dressing rooms where it's been terrible too. Some dressing rooms has been brilliant. And I think you have to treat a player like a person, number one. It's you forget the football, you forget players go through tough times, and a lot of times players have brain fog coming on the pitch, but there's a reason behind it. And again, I'm more of a curious kind of coach that would ask a question first to the player before almost wanting to judge him. So I try and take that on into consideration. That's not always easy, but at the same time, whenever you have that kind of relationship with a player and they have belief in you and vice versa, it's easy to fix mistakes or easier to fix mistakes. Or if someone has a little bit of inconsistency or falls off the ladder slightly, it's easier to get back on. It's so much easier because you're actually just talking as a human being. Quick example, I had a player sent off at the weekend. A lot of managers would have been probably pissed and kind of gutted and stuff like that there, and he's one of our best players. So naturally you're thinking, crap, I let him go home. I let him go and enjoy. His wife's pregnant. I let him go home to his family. All right, no problem. That's high performance. I think when you're in high performance, you forget that you're against opposition. Someone's dream is the same as your dream on the opposition. So there's going to be like a natural fight. So there's going to be pressure all the time. I just try and take it as a privilege because you're playing football. Pressure off the field. There's pressure in everyday life, and that's the difference. When you're in football, it's high performance, and there has to be a care and consideration for the player first and his mental well-being, I think. And this guy, for example, then if you were to say, hey, if I had to punish this player after being sent off, does he come back a better player? Or if I go, okay, high performance, these things happen, go home to your wife, come back again on Saturday, what reaction do you think I'm going to get? Now, I hope I get the good reaction now because it's mm-hmm. This is talking for next week, but that's the kind of person I want to be. That's the kind of respect. And I want the player to react in a good way. Now, it'll be different if the player doesn't react in a good way and then inconsistencies creep into the game. But if I manage it like that, I think I have a better chance of respect from the teammates. Players know that if something happens to them, they're not going to get, you know, absolute ridicule from me. It's going to be, guys, I sat in your seat as a footballer. I've been there. I've seen it. I've gone through the bad times. I know what it's like off the field to have moments of, you know, sadness. I think it's just being vulnerable. I think that you're saying about modern day, and I would say the emotional intelligence needs to come into play, the care, the leadership. I think even saw Sean Dyche touching on the other day. He's like, coaches these days are like soft psychologists, probably to a degree, because you can give everyone the tactic in the world, but if you don't have the respect, you ain't going to last. People see through you, you know, and I don't want to be effing and blind. I'm not that type of person anyway, but it's not like I've seen those dressing rooms and it just becomes toxic. I think your days are numbered if that's the case. So the better culture I can have, the better. But I think just a better kind of relationship with people is much higher, because again, just to touch on the two words, high performance is you're putting your body on the line every single day in training, every single match, and it's not always going to be perfect. So you're going to have days when you feel like crap, days when you feel great, and it's just trying to find that consistency.
Well, you're seeing that yield, let's say 100% start so far at the time of recording of the new season. hopefully that continues long into the campaign. Thomas Stewart, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. It's been a pleasure, and great luck for the rest of your season and what lies beyond as well.
Yes, I appreciate that. And listen, hopefully the next time we catch up, we're still at the top of the league or there and thereabouts.
An amazing, amazing conversation with Thomas Stewart there. Tam to his friends, which is not me and Joe. Mm. But I have a really, really weird question. Besides playing at Uetahogdal's IK, yeah, what did Thomas Stewart and Moses Duckwell have in common?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know where to begin here. Is this another club?
They have both released singles officially. Thomas Stewart, I found out after our interview.
Same.
He released a song about men's mental health a few years back, I think. Maybe not too long ago.
Yeah, I still haven't heard it.
Yeah, which Moses also has done since he is no longer professionally playing football. So I think that is very interesting. Maybe there's something that goes on when you go to Uetahogdal, when you're in Sweden. There's just something in the water. It's just a little bit clearer.
It's the attitude of the adventurers, the brave, the people that take on new things in their life.
Maybe we can A&R their collab.
Can do attitude. Look at that. Yeah. I do have one regret from this interview, and it wasn't not talking about the music. He very briefly mentions, when you ask him about falling in love with coaching, or when did he know that he wanted to be a coach after his playing career, he mentions that you did some coaching in Hawaii, and I didn't follow it up. I knew we were running out of time.
That was our white whale, as it was,
yes,
for season one. We need to get back on the train to Hawaii. We need to find it.
We do. Yeah, I mean, it sounded like he was coaching school kids, so it's slightly different, but even so, even if he's out there for a week, want to know about it.
But he was just generally a really interesting guest. Like, he just seemed to have lots of progressive ideas. Like, he's somebody who I'm genuinely going to be a little bit invested in his career and see where he goes from this, because I could see him climbing the ladder.
But yeah, that was this week's guest. We're trying to get back in the rhythm. I'm not saying something every week, but we do have a guest again next week, and you'll find out who via passport stamps and stuff on the social media. But what we will say is that who's left? A Welsh guest. We've got a Welsh guest. So we've completed the set in a couple of weeks. It just all worked out very nicely.
Don't you love when a plan comes together?
Indeed, indeed. The best way to find out, the soonest way to find out who we have on the show is our social media accounts. You've mentioned the handle once already, Scully. Could you repeat it for me, please?
INTL Clearance on TikTok and on Instagram, even X, formerly known as Twitter.
We're going to try and keep to this Wednesday rhythm again, but I should probably not even mention it because I know.
Listen,
what
you get it
like.
When you get it, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
best thing to do is to follow, subscribe, follow up all the social media, and you'll know when it's coming because we'll let you know.
Yeah, or if you just have it in your feed on, say, the podcast app, it's just going to appear. So
there
you'll
have
it when it's ready. But yeah, take your medicine, enjoy it while you can and when you can. Thank you for listening, as always. I've been Joe Walker.
I've been Scully.
See you next week on International Clearance.